Good morning. Some of you may have actually come in wondering what is this topic about. It's the formulation is strange. It's because you'll see what the shiur is about, but it's not going to become clear till we do the shiur. So the mystery will hopefully be unraveled and resolved as we go. The one of the highlights or one of the hallmarks of the Kriyas HaTorah that we had yesterday and we'll be having for the next, next week certainly, and off and on through the following weeks, is the preoccupation with the question of Tumah and Tahara. The question of, I'm going to use the words purity and impurity because there is no really precise translation of these words. Impurity tends to have a something of a of a hygienic kind of implication in English, and that's not what what Tumah is about. It's not what Tahara is about. Although I will add that we'll see that there is an emotional element to it, which is critical to its existence. One of the things that is critical to keep in mind when you talk about Tumah and Tahara is the fact, and most people react to this, is, yeah, okay, fine, but it's not halacha lemaisa. It's very theoretical, not unlike those of you who are plowing through the Daf Yomi, who just finished Svachim, and I will give you a Shekoach. That is not a small achievement. As more than one Gadol B'Yisrael has said, Kodshim is a whole different world, and you get a very rude awakening very quickly when you learn Svachim. Taharis is also a whole different world. It's something we're not used to. And in fact, it's sort of one of these, we have this idea that the whole concept of Tumah and Tahara is it falls into the category of Drush V'Kabel Schar. Study it, you get the Tzchar of Talmud Torah, but it really has no actual implications for our lives. In fact, on the more than that, the truth of the matter is that as anyone who ordinarily starts a shir in Hilchas Nida will tell you, and hence the reference to the title, there are, traditionally speaking, at least most Rishonim, many Rishonim, the dominant Rishonim, the Rambam is one of them, and of course I guess that counts for everything, and so there's all the Rishonim is the Rambam, would maintain that in fact the dinim of Nida are divided into two parts. There are those that are related to her as a person who is Tmeyah, who has Tumah, and those restrictions affecting her relations with her husband, what we call Isser Labala or Hetel Labala. They're two different parshios, they're not related, and hence we come to the conclusion, which is source number one. This is Rashi in Shabbos Daf Yud Gimel Amud Aleph. Please excuse my going back and forth between Ashkenazis and Sephardic. It's one of those things that those of us who moved to Israel, end up doing. When you learn, you fall back on Girsa the Yankusa, and when you say words outside the context of text, you speak in Sephardit, then you end up being Nishtehin. Anyways, the Rashi in this Dibra Maskel Shetisha and Bala, the discussion here about a woman sleeping with her husband. Rashi comments just en passant. He says, "Bizmana zeshe ein bo tahara." The concerns of Tumah and Tahara, Rashi says, just as a matter of fact, like as he's going along, it doesn't apply today. These are not concerns. So if a woman is tmeya per se, that's not a question in terms of worry concerning whether she'll be matami her husband, and he wouldn't be able to eat taharos if he's a kohen or go to the Beis HaMikdash, as it were, and so on and so forth. I want to show you that, in fact, this perception that from the time of the Churban, or perhaps a little bit later, the rules of Tumah and Tahara were not relevant, either halachically or experientially, is not correct. It's not exact. Okay? It's not precise, because those of us who are descended on any side from medieval Ashkenazim. Medieval Ashkenaz is approximately 950, 900 to approximately the year 1300. Actually, in classical Ashkenaz, categories and behaviors that were predicated upon Tumah and Tahara and their implications were not only followed, but they played a central role in the religious experience and the spiritual world of our ancestors. Let me be more precise in terms of the times. The traditionally, from at least from an intellectual point of view, the history of Ashkenaz is usually pegged at starting in the year 917, when the Kalonymous family immigrated from the city of Lucca in northern Italy. It's actually a southern Italian family, as evidenced by. Anybody have a mishpacha named Kalonymous? No? Wow, that's sort of strange. Okay. It's a quintessential Ashkenazic name, right? Kalonymous Kalman. Everybody knows about the PSS and the Rebbe. Very nice. Anybody know what the word means? The name means? It's a Greek name, of all things. It comes from Kale Nomos, good name. It's Shem Tov in Greek, because that was the language that Jews spoke in southern Italy for many centuries. Okay, anyways, starts in science, around 917, and I said 1300, probably 1306 would be the better date. By 1306, Jews are thrown out of France for the first time, and most of the Jews are made to leave. 1298, a few years before that, was a major persecution in Germany. It's always in Germany. Which begins a process of decline, from which Western Germany really never recovers. So those are usually the end points. Geographically, we're talking about France north of the Loire River, and Germany east of the Elbe-Zala line. Anything south of the Loire is more or less considered Provence. That's another halachic world. And anything that's east of the Elbe-Zala line at this point is really not that important. Of course, later it's going to become Poland, but that's not really our issue. Our issue right now. Okay, let's begin. One of the things that distinguishes Hasidim and Misnagdim is traditionally the fact that Hasidim have a tendency to go to mikveh in the morning before they daven. I'm well aware of the potency and the longevity of this minig. Because the men's mikveh on my hill in Efrat is literally around the corner, and you can see the parade of people with the schlepping towels of Hasidim and Neo Hasidim and New Agers, all of them sort of lining up for the men's mikveh, which sort of sometimes looks like the Packers or the Giants dressing room after a game, but that's what happens. That practice of going to mikveh before tefillah is based on a takana vezer, which is cited by the Gemara Baba Kama, that a balkeri, a person who has experienced some sort of a seminal ejaculation, whether it was through having relations with one's wife or was involuntary, should not daven until they go to mikveh. You have the Mishnah, the famous Mishnah in Brachas, number 2, Balkeri Maharir Belibo Veinav Mavarech Lo Lefaneh Velo Lachareha. A Balkeri should say Kriya Shema in his heart. He shouldn't say it. Machlokes Rishonim what this exactly means, but you shouldn't say it out loud the normal way, and you don't make the Brachas before, you don't make the Brachas afterwards, because those are the Rabbanan. And so on and so forth. In addition, there is a second takana that was also ordained by Ezra. Thank you. You also become illiterate in two languages when you move to Israel. So I'm always having a word finding problem, and it's always in the other language. So that's if I hesitate, that's what's going on. If you want to help me with the word, that would be wonderful. We'll get through with a bit more efficiency. The second takana is against learning Torah before you go to mikveh. The Gemara in Brachas, Daf Kaf Beis Amud Aleph, source number 3, provides us the rationale for that takana. Desanya, as a brisa, Vodat Levenecha Lebnei Banecha Yom Asher Amadet Lefnei Hashem Bechorev. You should experience. Whenever you open up a Gemara, the theophany at Sinai, when you stood before the veritable presence of God, and so says the Gemara, Malahalan be'emo be'irav resus v'ziyah, afkan be'emo be'irav resus v'ziyah. Just as people stood at Sinai and they were quaking from fear, we know what happened. We know what happened. They ran away. They couldn't take it. They couldn't after the first two rivers, the Jews ran away. They said, "You talk to we can't handle it." They told Moshe Rabbeinu, "You talk to God. We'll listen. We're cool, but we can't. This is too much. This is too much for us." The same type of awestruck, transforming kind of experience should be experienced by everyone every single time they learn Torah. The Rav Zeket Zadok Livracha of Rabbi, on many occasions, used to point out that in fact this is the key to the whole question of the nature of Talmud Torah. Talmud Torah is not just an intellectual exercise, as he said on one famous occasion. It is an ecstatic experience. It's an experience in which man should encounter God. The a person who just learns for the intellectual satisfaction, or is just running through the learning, or just concentrating on the Shakala Mitarya, misses the point, or at least misses 50% of the point. In fact, I heard a whisper of that same position. There's a famous story about a bacher from Masechta Tiferes Yerushalayim who was learning Bekiyas in the Beis Medrash, and he went up to Reb Meisher Feinstein Zatzal and said, "Rebbe, I just went through 15 Blat Gemara," and Reb Meisher said, "Well, how many went through you?" I don't think it's just a question of his comprehension. I believe it's a question of also the experiential end of things. In any event, those are two separate takonos. Now, the Rav actually was not of the opinion that the second takona against study before going to mikveh was related to the tumah. But nevertheless, the Gemara goes, at least from a formal point of view, goes on that assumption. And despite the fact that the two takonos were in fact issued at the same time, one of them was by the period of the Mishnah was in fact abrogated. If you take a look at the last three lines, it's 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, three lines up. Tanya, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira haya omer ein divrei Torah makablim tuma. That divrei Torah are not makabel tuma, and therefore there's no need to go to mikvah on the part of a bal keri. Excuse me. There was one Talmud who was, was less than clear in the presence of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. Amale, bini petach picha ve'yirut v'recha. Open your mouth and talk. Now, those of us again, I'm dating myself, and I walk around. And the Rav has a famous drusha that he gave at the Smicha convocation in 1970, on the occasion of the move to separate yeshiva from the college, and the name of the name that was attached to this speech was called "I See Ghosts." So I walk around. It's been 30 years since I was here for any extended period of time. So I also walk around and I see ghosts. One of the ghosts that I see frequently is the Rav, and if anybody sat in the Rav Shir, they know that, in fact, all the Rav had to do was look at you, and you would be Megamgame Lamala Mi Moreno. So I understand this Talmud of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. Anyways, Amalei b'ni p'tach picha v'yerid v'recha, open your mouth and talk. She'ein divrei Torah mekabel tumah. If you're a Balkeri, don't worry, because divrei Torah not mekabel tumah. If you didn't go to mikveh, it's okay. Alright, so that's number one. So to sum up to this point, what do we see? Ezra made two takanos, two ordinances. One against the Balkeri going davening before tefillah, and another one against learning before going to mikveh. Now, most early Rishonim go on the assumption that we're talking about two separate ordinances. Therefore, based on this Gemara, what do we deduce? That in fact only the one about Talmud Torah was abrogated. Okay? How Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira was able to overturn the Takon of Ezra, we'll talk about later. maybe if we get to it. Okay? But one was abrogated, one wasn't. The one about tefillah, about prayer, remained. Okay? Nevertheless, there's a clear divergence between the Minhagim of Eretz Yisrael, or the Chachmei Eretz Yisrael, and the Chachamim in Bavel as to the obligatory nature of that takana, of the ordinance of immersing in a mikveh, at least, before prayer. The sukkahs in the Bavli are very, very, they're not clear, because they convey all kinds of different positions. But the overall upshot of those sugyas is that at the maximum, in Bavel, people would shower. Tes kabim. You would pour 9 kabim of water on you, you take a shower. Okay, on yourself before davening. But that's not tefillin and mikveh. Mikveh is a very clear entity. We wouldn't say that a woman can take a shower and then that's it instead of a mikveh. And by the way, one of the great battles that Maimonides waged when he came to Egypt was and this was an ongoing battle. We know that it was still going on when the Radbaz and Rabbi David ibn Abi Zimra came to Egypt from Spain in the 16th century. Was the Karaites did not require a normal mikveh for a nida. They said going to a bathtub or a pool was sufficient. And the Rambam and the all the way from the Rambam to the Radbaz from the 12th century to the 16th century, there was a problem in terms of getting women to go to a normal mikveh before they resumed relations with their husbands. The upshot being that whatever the implication, whatever the feeling was of the Amoraim in Bavel, this was not a full sense of tuma as maintained evidently by the original takana of Ezra. In Eretz Yisrael, the opposite was the case. And here you have to keep in mind there is the story of the oppositions and the differences of opinion. And it was a real milchamta shel Torah, but it was still a war. Which could become incredibly ferocious between the two sides, between the traditions of Eretz Yisrael and the traditions of Babylonia, went on for hundreds of years, and it was not resolved. Well, one could argue it was never resolved, but it was not really resolved till deep into the Middle Ages. Those of you who might have gone to shul yesterday morning and discovered that shul was incredibly long due to the addition of extensive liturgical poetic additions to the service. Anybody say Yaitzus in shul yesterday? Oh, good. We have tzaddikim here. So, what was the point? What was the point of the? What's that about? What keeps us in shul? You know, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur forever and ever. Even though, you know, that as time goes on, less and less piyutim gets said. Because that fact is rooted in the same difference of opinion between Bavel and Eretz Yisrael. The opinion of the Bavli and Chachmei Bavel is that one is not allowed to expand the liturgy of the Shemoneh Esrei. Whether it's the Shemoneh Esrei for Yontif or the Shemoneh Esrei for Chol, generally as a matter, certainly we all know the halacha of Shmuel that you're not allowed to ask anything, you're not allowed to, allowed to add Shailas Sorachim, your personal requirements, in the first what? 3 brachas, or in the first and the last 3 brachas. Those are set, those are fixed and finished, and in fact even the addition of Zachreinu L'chaim is a problematic on Duryam Narayim is a problematic addition which the post going have to somehow justify. And what's the halacha? If you forgot it, what happens? You don't go back. When in doubt, leave it out. The great klal in certainly in Hilchas Tefillah, and it actually applies to all kinds of other things in halacha too. You didn't know the Chazal knew how to rhyme in English. Okay. On the other hand, if you think about it, where are most of the piyutim said? Ashkenazim say piyutim. Where do they say most of their piyutim? All the ones we love to say, Unisane Tokef, and I don't know, you know, Haderes Ve'amuna, and Vavisa. What? Nu where? What bracha? What bracha? What bracha? Nu? Kedusha. I mean, in other words, what we do flies straight in the face of a memra, of an explicit memra of Shmuel that says you're not supposed to add anything in those brachas. And that's where we sit there. I mean, we sit there in the Shabbat, Yom Kippur morning, that's all we do. Yom Kippur Shacharis is the longest Shacharis in the history of the world. Because it goes on and on and on. And if you really want to see long, you should look in the old Machzorim, because then they really say Piyutim. So what's this? Because Chachmei Eretz Yisrael took the opposite position. Their position was that, in fact, the text, the format of the Shemoneh Esrei is much more flexible than they think in Bavel, and it's a mitzvah to adapt the nusach of the tefillah to the requirements of every single individual yontif. To the extent, by the way, that in Eretz Yisrael they had a different kiddush for every yontif and a different especially a different kiddush for every yontif. Because every yontif, in fact, it's in the end. There's a famous comment of the Torah Tzimima in his Parish on the Siddur. He might have to say this in the Torah Tzimima too, where he comments that when we finish the Kiddush or the Birkas Hayom on yontif, Baruch Atah Hashem Hakadosh Az Yisrael Vazmanim, that the zmanim is a blank. That they used to say Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, whatever. The Rav used to inveigh very strongly against that the logic in that comment. But at the end of the day, in the Geniza, they discovered that in fact, no, they used to really tuck it. They had, just like we have Mekadesh Yisrael v'Yom HaZikaron, which we do say actually. That they actually did adapt everything to every single day. So this idea of expanding the tefillah is a testimony to the profound impact of the traditions of Eretz Yisrael on Ashkenazic liturgy and Ashkenazic practice. This is a lot of others. Anyways, there's a bunch of compositions that were put together in the period of the Gaonim, detailing the differences between the Jews in Eretz Yisrael and the Jews in Bavel. One of them is the famous one called Sefer Chilukim Bein Bnei Mizrach Ubnei Marav, the book of the differences between the Jews and the people in the East and the people in the West. This is number 9. This is number 9 in that book. This is number 4 on your sheet. Anshe Mizrach en Rochtzin Lo Mikeri V'Lo B'Tashmei Tashmei Shamita. That that Jews in Bavel do not bathe, do not wash themselves after having some kind of seminal emission, whether it was an involuntary emission, obviously, or after they had relations with their wives. Okay, in other words, balei keri shehein dorshim anu baretz tmeya. They said the whole takana doesn't apply. We live in chutz laaretz says tumat tametz amim. Okay, we don't have to do it. Ubnei Eretz Yisrael rochtzin mitash mishamita umikeri. But in Eretz Yisrael, they do bathe. It would seem that they go to mikvah. Afilu biyom hakipurim. Okay, what's wrong with this? What? You're not supposed to bathe on Yom Kippur. It's one of the heinuyim. What's the exception? Atfilu bizmano. When you have a tefillah that you have to do, and Yom Kippur ends up to be the time, in the days when Tum and Tahara were relevant, that was not considered to be a rechitza shel tanuk. It was not considered to be bathing, which was for enjoyment, but rather for a mitzvah. We know that mitzvahs lav lehanos nitnu, that when you do a mitzvah, it may be enjoyable, but it's not classified as hanos, so that it would fall into the category of prohibited action. And therefore, they would go on Yom Kippur to mikvah. And so they accounted this immersion, this tefillah, as a mitzvah, and because if they didn't, what would be the implication if they didn't go to mikvah? Why is it a mitzvah? You can't daven otherwise. So you can't daven otherwise. So therefore they would go to mikvah, because that makes it a tefillah b'zmana mikvah. It would be tefillah b'zmana. It's a mitzvah, and therefore they would go. So they're really quite, they're quite extreme in terms of their positions. I will add something, by the way. One of the most interesting polemics that you don't pick it up, because sometimes Tosfos sort of says it sotto voce, under its breath. There was an extensive this minhag carried over, okay, into Franco-Germany, into the Ashkenaz. After a while, they were able to stop people from going to mikvah on we'll see in a minute on Yom Kippur. But when does everybody go to mikvah? All the guys, Erev Yom Kippur. They eat. So central was that tefillah taken to be that there was a minute that they couldn't get rid of to make a bracha on that. And so the Baal HaTosfos from Rashi already, from the time of Rashi on, every single posek worth his salt screams Chai V'Kayim. By the way, why do we say, what's Chai V'Kayim mean? What do you mean Chai? Where do you get the idea of Chai V'Kayim? Shrine Chai V'Kayim. What? Correct, because we screamed that out at the end of the Sinai Tokyo, so it became the Shrine Chai V'Kayim. All right, that was just a joint test if you were awake. So they scream Chai V'Kayim, that this making a bracha over this tefillah. It's a bracha levatola, and they scream and they yell and they carry on. But the truth of the matter is, if for 300 years the Rishonim are screaming and yelling and carrying on that they shouldn't make the bracha, what does that tell you? It means that people are still doing it. Why are people still doing it? Because it's a meaningful action. We'll come back to that. Okay, to keep that in mind. All right. So we've seen that A, we have this takana of Ezra. B, we have the two takanas of Ezra. One takana, according to Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira, no longer applies. We saw that in Bavel, more or less, the takana against tefila of tefila with a base before tefila with a pay fell off, or you needed a shower. So what the Rambam says. And among in Eretz Yisrael, they're still going to mikvah. What goes on? Okay, now let's follow the paper trail, and we'll go to Ashkenaz. We'll go to France and Germany in the time of Rashi and the Baal HaTosfos. Okay, take a look at number 5. The Or Zeruah by Rabbi Yitzchak ben Moshe Avina. Is a compilation of, as with most Ashkenazic halacha books, Ashkenazim generally don't write sifrei psak. They don't write poskim. They write collections. They put together collections of sources that poskim can use. You don't find Ashkenazim generally, in fact, you almost never find Ashkenazim who write codes that everyone should follow unilaterally. This is the din finish. There's no Ashkenazic riff. Rambam. The Torah is an interesting case because he was an Ashkenazi by birth, or the Shulchan Aruch. On the contrary, what Ashkenazim do is they mix it up. They add all kinds of comments in order to give more opinions. It's a part of a broader phenomenon. So the Or Zeruah is a sefer halacha, but it's not really, he paskins, but it's not like every organized like this is what you're supposed to do. It's more a matter of a source book. So, anyways, see, Kei Kai has a long essay in Siman Kuf Yud Zion about the question of the status of Baal Keri. All right? And after going through the whole thing about how the Bavli says you really have to, and so on and so forth, it finally comes down and says, Miulis Palel, nevertheless, when it comes to davening, everybody knows that we're machmir, velo matzlu, and they don't daven. They don't daven until they have somehow purified themselves from Keri. Vafilu Baal Keri. And even a Baal Keri, the question, what are we talking about? Achi itin of tes kabin mayim, unless the minimum is to take a shower with tes kabin, which is a maisa hamataya. Dedicated none, hayomid with tefillah, beniskar, and so on and so forth. Shmamina sha'asr lispalel kshu Baal Keri. It is asr to daven when you're a Baal Keri. Period. Okay? V'chein amadvar, that's what people do. Shinagu kol yisrael limana min atfila at shiitaru b'nesinas teska bin mayim. The Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira lo pater ela b'divrei Torah. Aval atfila lo pater. You have to at least take a shower, okay? And Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira only exempted people when it came to Torah. So all male Jews. Made sure if they were Baal Keri to have some kind of Maisa HaMetayer. The question is, so why? Whereas in the Sephardic orbit, which is follows Bavel, it was considered to be something of a supererogatory, sort of like a Midas Chasidus. This is considered to be an issur. You don't daven, and if you didn't shower, forget it. Sephardic. If you didn't have the 9 kabin, and it's not a short shower. It's got to be the 9 kabin. The shear is what's important over here. What? Shabbos too. Shabbos too? You know what? We, our attitude towards showering on Shabbos is a taboo. However, in Israel, there's a lot more flex in terms of people taking cold showers when it's really hot. There are all kinds of heterim in the Beit Shan Valley that were given years ago. There's all kinds of, I mean, I'm not advising it. But there's a lot more flex elsewhere on these issues. By the way, why not go to mikveh? So one of the reasons why I go to mikveh is very simple. They didn't, a lot of Rishonim did not think that you could heat mikvehs. Which says a lot about the Mesiris Nefesh of the women. But this evidently, that's evidently part of the considerations here. In any event, so you see here that you have this. The sense in Ashkenaz is you can't daven. I mean, it's also to daven. We're machmir, and it's wonderful, and so on and so forth. In fact, take a look at the Ravya. The Ravya, who's a generation before, he's the Rebbe of the Or Zeruah. The Or Zeruah lived in Vienna. By the way, if you ever go to Vienna, if you go to the old Judengasse, there's a new Judengasse. There's the one near the Stadt Temple, but there's also further up the Danube is the old Judengasse. There's a Holocaust memorial, but underneath the Holocaust memorial, they discovered the remains of the medieval shul that was the shul of the Or Zeruah. And it dates, it was built almost exactly the same time as the Altneu shul in Prague. So it's an interesting thing to be able to stand where the Or Zeruah lived and wrote the Or Zeruah, because Mestame, he had his yeshiva in the shul. All right, anyways. I take groups to groups. In any event, the Ravya was his Rebbe. What's important for us right now is simply this, the bold line that I had. He comes to the conclusion. It's interesting. He comes to the conclusion that you really don't have to bathe. A balkari, the takana probably doesn't apply. But if you're machmir, you're marich yamim v'shanim. No, he has a situation in which his gut, his ritual gut, his what we call religious policy gut, tells him you should. And obviously the minig was that way. And the sources say he's putter. So he emphatically says no. You should do it anyways. Okay. Don't forget, in the Ashkenaz, and only among Ashkenazim, do you find the power of a minig to overturn what is the apparent upshot of of the halacha. The classic example is in the first daf and first amud in Shas, that the Ashkenazi minig was to daven Ma'ariv early in the summer. When I say early, I mean really early. The 15th century Posek, the Trumas Edeshin, who lived in Wiener Neustadt, because Jews weren't allowed to live in Vienna at the time, writes that he heard from his grandfather, Rabbi Yisrael of Krems, who was known for having been the author of the Hagos HaShri, that in Krems they used to go Erev Shabbos, they come home, they would come home and they would bathe and they would go to shul and they go to dinner and then everybody go out for a walk along the Danube and they go home and go to bed be'od hayom godel, before sunset. All this happens before sunset, because the sun sets at 10 o'clock at night there in the summer, and no word about saying Kriya Shema again. In other words, the president of the shul didn't get up at the end of the early minyan on Shabbos and say, don't forget to say Kriya Shema again. Nobody said it because the minig was that way, and a problematic position, but that's the classic example of the power of minig. And here, where the upshot seems to be that you don't have to do it, so nevertheless you should do it. Okay? The bottom line is that people were not davening if they were Balei Keri unless they either went to mikveh or they had test cabin. What's striking is, so maybe it's just stama chumra. What's striking is number 7. When I saw this, my eyes bugged out. This is Piskei Taisa. It's not one of the Rishonim we look at a lot, if ever, except for historians like me who look for all kinds of oddities, right? Number 7. Piskei Tosfos in Shabbos Simon Reish Samach Beis adds V'yesh Machmirim Litbol L'Divrei Torah. All of a sudden, Reb Yehuda ben Becerra, yeah, very nice, but they're doing it anyways. People who have been with their wives or had an involuntary carry are going to mikveh before they learn Torah and will not learn unless they unless they go to unless they go to mikvah. Okay, now that's a lot of concern with tuma and tahara and mikvah on the as part of the daily life. I mean, people are with their wives. Things happen. You know, you become tame, and it was just a given that it would be usur. I mean, how else can I put it? Davening without going to mikveh, or davening without teskabin, was like eating treif. Okay? Think about, you know what? Think about, on a lighter note, okay? Did anybody see the video that Jon Stewart did about the Erev in the Hamptons? Okay? You saw the look of the guy from I know the guy from the Jewish community. But you see the look of the guy in the Jewish community at the interviewer who's sitting there eating a bacon and cheese on a bag. It was like, that's an attitude of revulsion which you have from something that's awesome. So imagine having the same attitude of, what? I should daven when I'm tame? Otherwise, you can't understand the emphatic. If you don't understand there's an emotion, a very heavy religious emotional element to this, you don't understand the emphatic way in which the Ravya discusses it, and the fact that people would, you know, revive this Divrei Torah thing. All right? Adkan. Oh, good. We're doing well. That's one type of Tumah and Tahara, which clearly went, and I cited the Orzaru here for a reason, because that's towards the end of Ashkenaz. Okay, so the entire period, this is the way our ancestors in France and Germany are acting. Now, in general, in the world of Tumah and Tahara, you know, if you look at the Gemara, so who's worried about Tumah and Tahara? When is it really an issue? So one place that's an issue is for Kohanim. And if you go through the upper city in Yerushalayim, which is opposite the Jewish quarter, you find the remains of Kohanim's houses, and every Kohen's house has what? Has a mikveh. Why? Because you can't eat truma, and you can't eat a lot of other things. You can't go to the base of mikveh. You can't eat kachim kalim, and you can't eat kachim kachim in the base of mikdash, unless you're tahor. So and because it's very easy to become tameh if you're among people, then you got to have a mikveh all the time. By the way, the bridge that connected the Beis HaMikdash with the Rova, which runs over it actually runs over Nativ Bina. It actually runs over Rav Bina's yeshiva, or the remains of it are actually underneath, was all stone, had nothing else but stone. Why? Because stone is not makabel tumah, and the Kohanim could easily go back and forth with minimizing the possibility of becoming tumah. So it's a problem for Kohanim. So Kohanim have problems. Okay, Kohanim also get benefits, so they get problems. Why would the question of Tumah and Tahara be a question for the average citizen? If they want to go to Yerushalayim, if it's Erev Pesach, like now, that's why we read Parshas Parah last week, right? Because you have to be eat the Korban Pesach. Very nice. Okay. What else? If again anything related to the Beis HaMikdash, you're bringing Maaser Sheni, you're bringing you have a backyard and you're bringing Neta Ravai, whatever the case might be. Ostensibly, there's no Isser to be Tameh. You're Tameh, we're all Tameh. We're walking around being here. There's no Isser. Okay. However, from the time of before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, there developed a very strong practice among an increasingly large number of people to aspire to live a life of what the scholars called Levitical purity, meaning that they would act as if they were Kohanim, and everything that they were eating was truma, and would apply to their daily lives all of the rules and regulations which regard eating truma. This is called the practice of eating chulin b'tahara, eating non-sacred foods, non-truma foods, in a state of ritual purity, which requires all kinds of adjustments. It's not an easy thing to do. It was the hallmark of a group of tanoim and their followers who, were called chaverim. They would eat chulin b'tahara, which, by the way, it had a lot of ramifications. For example, you couldn't accept every dinner invitation, And many of these chaverim had closed communities. In fact, we know, for example, there was a group of talmidim of Rabbi Meir who were called the Kahala Kadisha de Yerushalayim, the sacred community of Jerusalem. One of the things that they were, and they were a closed community, they lived in Jerusalem, and one of the things that marked their lives was the fact that they would eat chulin b'tahara. Another thing, by the way, that would be makpid, by the way, was always to divide it equal time for working and making a living and learning Torah. But that's more maybe more polemical talk we'll give some time. The attitude of the Torah towards labor. In any event, so this question of chulin b'tahara was actually quite common, especially among Tanoim. Take a look at number 8. We have a very precious testimony, which comes to us from the end of the second, beginning of the third century CE. Rabbi Chiya Rabba. Rabbi Chiya was the Talmud Muvak of Rebbe. Rabbi Chiya put together the Tosefta. Rabbi Chiya Rabba, he was also the uncle of Rav. So Rabbi Chiya Rabba, or Ruba, mafkid l'Rav. He told his nephew Rav, "In at yochel mechel kol shata chulin b'tara echol. If you can eat chulin b'tara all year long, you absolutely should do so. Okay, if you can maintain that discipline, vakasha. V'im lav, however, if you're not really capable of doing that on a regular basis, and it really does require a tremendous investment, I don't mean of money, but of awareness, it's going to be exhausting to keep up with all this stuff. Tehei achol shiva yomin min shata." At least, the Rishabi says, at least do it 7 days a year. Okay. Now, what are the 7 days a year? So here, Machlokas Rishon. The one opinion has it just on Chagim. If you add up all the days of the Chagim, it comes to 7, if you're living in Eretz Yisrael. The other opinion has it that the Shiva, these 7 days are actually the non-Yontif days of Aseres Yemei Tshuva. Okay, the assumption being that you're eating Chulin B'Tahara on Rosh Hashanah, or the minig in Eretz Yisrael among many was to fast on Rosh Hashanah. This is another one of these Eretz Yisrael Bavel debates. If you take a look in Poskim, there's big long discussions about fast, about not fasting, big polemics on it, very strong statements against fasting on Rosh Hashanah. It's one of the reasons why, it's one of the reasons why. Don't you ever ask yourself, how could Yom Kippur we can start davening at 8 o'clock, right? A lot of people start at 8 o'clock, or whatever, because you're going to be in shul all day anyways. You'll make the zman for Kriya Shema and goodbye. But Rosh Hashanah, you got to start at 7 o'clock. What's 7 o'clock? What's it? So they'll tell you because you shouldn't go through a half a day before you ate because it's usher to fast on Rosh Hashanah. The reason for that minig was because it was an established minig among Bnei Eretz Yisrael dafka too fast on Rosh Hashanah. And if you think about the logic, there is something to it. There were those who, in fact, who would fast every day of Aseres Yemei Tshuva, with the exception of Erev Yom Kippur. There was also a minhag to fast on Shabbos, by the way. It's a day totally spiritual, so therefore why have Gashmis? In fact, there were those who have argued that if you take a look at the Shiltis was written by Rav Acha Mishabcha when he went to Eretz Yisrael as a way of introducing or spreading the Torah of Bavel among the Jews of Eretz Yisrael. He talks about a lot of many things. It's a wonderful sefer. I mean, with the parish and the Netziv, you can't have a better limud. It's unbelievable, okay? But one of the striking things about that sefer is the fact that he deals with the question of Onik Shabbos and the prohibition against, as he says, against fasting 3 times. Okay, he deals with it almost more than any other topic in the whole Kol HaTorah Kula. So you gotta ask yourself, how come? So clearly, he felt the need. He had to come back to this topic 3 different times because this was a matter of dispute. In fact, we still have an echo of this minig of fasting every single day during a Aseres Yemei Tshuva. How many? What's the minimum number of days of slichas you can have? 4. Why? Mr. Brewer already says it. You know, you have to go to ancient sources. Because ostensibly you should be fasting all of Aseres Yemei Tshuva. But since you can't fast all of Aseres Yemei Tshuva, you fast for 4 days before Rosh Hashanah and say Slichas to make up for 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, Shabbos, and Erev Yom Kippur. So that's a distant echo of that machlekes. In fact, in the manuscripts of some of the Besvarim, like the Sefer Amanig, which describes different customs and practices, there's almost a holy war about you can see that different Sofrim put in Lihisanos and also Lihisanos and Lihisanos and also, and they cross out and put in, and like the it takes it's like the you know what, Lahavdil Elef, I think Lahavdil Elef Dals, it's like if you look at the edit section of the article, the biography of the Lubavitcher Rebbe on Wikipedia, the interesting part is not the article, the interesting part is the editing page where people are fighting it out as to what you should write and what you shouldn't write, and who's, and whether it's this way, it's between the Mishichistim and the non-Mishichistim, and this one and that one. That's what goes on in, I said Lahatmeh, I should say Lahatmeh. It goes on the page. All right, let's go on. In any event, so Reb Chiya is saying, you should have some sort of, he tells Rav, his nephew, you should do some sort of memory, of some sort of maintenance of this minig. Okay? Yafeh. All right, he's an Eretz Yisrael. What do you require to be able to eat chulin b'tahara, by the way? What's clearly conditio sine qua non? You have to be tar. What do you need to be tar?
Paraduma.
So, when the Beis HaMikdash was burning, some very, zachur latov, some kohen kept his wits about him, and took and saved the aether, the ashes of the last para aduma, and that para aduma lasted, because all you need is a little bit of just a little bit of ash goes a long way. That para aduma, we know, was still being used by people eating chulin batara deep into the 4th century CE, deep in the time of the Yerushalmi. We know it, okay? We know it from Yerushalmi and Brachas. Yerushalmi and Brachas is number 9. Rabbi Chagai, Rabbi Yirmiya, Salkun lebei Chan v'so kofatz Rabbi Chagai uberich aleihem. The question, the Yerushalmi over there is making brachas over mitzvahs. It says Rabbi Chagai, Rabbi Yirmiya, this is in the third century, in the fourth century CE, went up lebei Chan v'so. It sounds like some kind of a store, and Rabbi Chagai went up and he made a bracha. But what kind of bracha is to make in a store? You know, when people go to stores, usually they have to make some kind of bracha. I mean, the Diana Emes for the money you spent. I don't know. But you make a bracha walking into the store. So the girsa in this Yerushalmi is evidently not correct. The proper girsa is actually in the alluded to in the Rokeach, and we found in other Midrashim actually that are in manuscripts that wasn't on the Bar Ilan CD, and of course, as usual, that's what we're restricted to over here. That the girsa is Rab Chagai, Rabbi Yirmiya Salkun lebei Chatosa. They went to go undergo the sprinkling of the Efer Para, of the Para Duma, and the question was, do you make a bracha over that Kima Mitzvah or not? If you take a look at the Rokeach, the Sefer Rokeach in the late 12th, early 13th century, in Worms, paraphrases it, at the bottom it says, Rishalmi Perakates and Mavarchin Gabi Kiddush Ve'efer Chatas Lahazos Kola Mitzvos Te'unim Bracha. Now, so all that's well and good in the time of Chazal, in the time of the Maraim, in Eretz Yisrael, they got here for Parah, else is good, they can do whatever they want, Fartik, wonderful, okay? Come to number 10, and you don't know what you're talking about. You don't, Mamish, they don't know what you're talking about. Comes the Machzor Vitri. The Machzor Vitri was edited in the first edition by a Talmud of Rashi, Rab Shemaria, and then it was edited and added to and so on and so forth, but it certainly reflects the life of the Jews in France in the 11th century before Rashi and after Rashi. Kumta Rhein, you come to the Simon about Shin Lamed Zayin, about Aseres Yomei Tshuva, and you don't know what to do with yourself. Aseres Yomim Shebein Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, says the Machzor Vitri, he brings the Gemara in Yerushalmi. You should eat chulin b'tara for 10 days. What's got to do? How much chulin b'tara do you have in Troyes? How much chulin b'tara do you have in Washington Heights? It's lots of tara in Washington Heights, but it's a spiritual tara. It's not tepes. It's not what the Gemara had in mind. Ma kahakan. And then he says, babe, what's there 7 days, and it's got to be this and that. What are you talking about? And this is a halacha book. He didn't have to quote this. He could have said, you should do all kinds of things. You should do tshuva, sarisim me tshuva. You should add zachreinu. He says this. Say zachreinu and say micha mocha. And you should give tzedakah. And you should say slichi. I don't know. You know, all kinds of stuff you can say. What's got to do? What? So you have to ask, you got to ask the question. Is it possible that people in Ashkenaz were trying to keep Chulin B'Tahara in the Middle Ages? The answer is apparently yes. There are two statements in Sefer Chassidim which clearly indicate this. Now there's even a longer passage. The truth is, there's a long passage in a Sefer that was written by the Rebbe of the Rokeach. His name was Rabbi Yudim Klonimus, and the Sefer is called Sefer Erchei Tanoim V'Amoroyim. But it's just so long and involved, I didn't cite it. But the Sefer Chassidim is accessible. But let me make a caveat to you. Not everything in Sefer Chassidim is about rolling around in the snow if you want to do tshuva. Much of Sefer Chassidim are novel halachic rulings and non-halachic rulings by Rabbi Yehuda Chassid, which did not make it into the mainstream. But very often, okay, what Rabbi Yehuda Chassid describes is simply what Jews in Ashkenaz do. Period. Not the Chassidim. There were no Chassidim. There were Chassidim. The difference between a Chassid and a Chassid is a Chassid. What's a Chassid? I think it's important to clarify this early. What's a Chassid? No. What is a chassid? Is a person who does live Mishur Sadin. He's a person who aspires of his own volition to do more than God requires because he wants to be miskarev, he wants to come closer to God. So the Torah says, X, you do more. But it's a matter of spiritual autonomy. The chassid, a tzaddik is a person who is mechalkel kol dvar masa b'tzedek, even-handed, reasonable, whatever. But the chassid goes beyond that. Chesed is always flowing, right? You're gomel chesed. It comes out of you. That's the upshot. That's the pashup shot. They use the words chesed and chassid in Tanakh. What are the chassidim arishonim in the Mishnah? There are people are doing more than you have to. They're sitting in shul 3 hours before and 4 hours afterwards, and they're cleaning up the streets. There shouldn't be all kinds of problems, all kinds of things to cause damage. They do more than what's required. A chassid is the exact opposite. What the chassidus of the Besh did was turn the word upside down, and to turn it into a person who is dependent upon the Rebbe, which is the way we use it today. He's a chassid of X. He's not independent. He's a person who depends on that person. So there's all different word between chassid and chassid. I remember when I got smicha, and I took a look at the signature, and the Rav signed Yosef Dov Ben Moreno Ben Arav Hachassid Moshe Levi Soloveitchik. I learned by the Rav for 9.5 years. I knew he wasn't the chassid, and Reb Meisher Zicher wasn't the chassid. So what was it? Because he wasn't saying chassid. He was saying chassid. And in fact, the classic biography of the Gra is called what? Hagaon HaChassid MiVilna. And believe me, it wasn't written by the Baal HaTanya either. Yeah. In the pre-Beshtian world, none. In the post-Beshtian world, you had rabbis in town, you had rabbis in town. Rabbi Yankov Kalliner was a Talmud in the Volozhiny Yeshiva, and the Kalliner Rebbe was in town too. Different worlds. Anyways, I see we're coming down to the end. Let's take a look at these two cases. So in these two cases, I believe firmly, based on the Machzor Vitri, that in fact Sefer Chassidim is describing what you do and not something that's extraordinary. Number one, he just says as a statement that you have to keep. He quotes the Yerushalmi. He says it between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. But take a look at the last line. Afal pisha tmei mesim hayu ve'enei for parat sivol olios shiva yamin b'shana ochel chulin b'tara. It's a contradiction in terms. There's no way for para, but nevertheless you do eat chulin b'tara. What does it mean? Try to approximate it as much as humanly possible. What do you conclude from that? That eating chulin b'tahara was a meaningful religious category. as much as you can do it. The next one I love because it shows you what you can possibly do to do this. Ma'aseh b'chosed echad shaya ragil liknos yerek v'kitne shaya chosech ba'atzmo min ha'aruga. He would harvest his own vegetables. V'lo haya moser tikun ma'acholo biyad goy v'shivcha. He wouldn't have the help to prepare his food. V'lo biyad atzel, or anybody who wasn't scrupulous, ki lo hayu misakdin ma'acholo b'tara. He wouldn't let, for example, I assume that he would make sure that the food was, he didn't want the food to get wet, it shouldn't be mukshal kabel tuma, whatever the case might be. He prepared his own food in order to make sure that he could eat chulin bitara. All right? And this is not, so this is a case of a chassid, but we're not talking about something which is unusual. Okay, because machzer vitri refers to everybody, not to the, not just to extraordinary people. Let me just close. I had mentioned before the possibility that Tuma and Tahara were religious experiential moments. What did a Jew feel? It's very hard to elicit what people feel, you know, from the distance of 1,000 years. But it is actually possible. Rashi in his Perush on Yecheskel, the pasuk is Vayomer Shem Kacha Yochlu Bnei Yisrael Eslachamam Tomei Bagoyim Asher Edeim Sham. Rashi says, what is Tameh Lashon Ma'us? Something which is Tameh is something which is disgusting. It's something which is revolting. It's something that you recoil from. Okay? So obviously, Tuma had a very powerful emotional valence for the average person. You see it as well in number 14. That interesting sefer called Shelus Tshuvos Min HaShamayim. Rabbi Yaakov of Mervej, who was a Provençal Rav who moved north, he would have shilas, he'd go to sleep, and the Malach would come and give him the answers. It's a big machlokas among Achronim. Can you rely on the Sefer or not? It's all a question of the Rambam and the Tanur Shel Achnoi. Lo b'shamayimi, yeh b'shamayimi, a famous business with the Groh, that the Groh, if he figured out anything in his dreams, he wouldn't rely on it unless he was awake. He would only rely on pshotim and solutions he came up to when he was awake. So, in any event, but nevertheless, he would get up in the morning and write down the answers. So he asked the question of the Malach. He says, can a Balkeri daven for the Yom? Okay. The answer is really striking. Veshivu, and the Yeshiva Shomala responded. This is, he's a exact contemporary of Rebbeinu Tam, 12th century. Vavadatem Hashem Elokeichem, Heveo Merzit Tefillah, Gemara in Tainus. But the answer is striking. The Efshir Tamei Makriv Korban? That's an amazing answer. Not Mutter, not Usser. Absolute shock. That you would have the temerity to let a Balkeri go daven by the Amid? How can you even think of that with the new word in the Oxford English Dictionary? OMG! Oh my God! We don't think in this kind of terms. Now, this kind of power, that the idea of experiencing Tahara and recoiling from Tuma also found expression in another end. I mentioned before, and with this we'll close. I mentioned before that not only did Jews go to mikveh Erev Yom Kippur, but they felt that the burden of the obligation to go to mikveh was so intense that they would say a bracha. They were willing to take the risk of being motzei shem shamayim levatala. Okay. In order to emphasize the importance of this, they were so convinced that this tefillah was important. Now, this tefillah was important, yes, in terms of the question of Keri, there's no question. However, if you take a look at number 15, there was something else to it. The Oz Leruah quotes his Rebbe, Reb Simcha Shpaya. Adam Shaharag Nefesh B'Shogeg, a person was guilty of involuntary manslaughter. Im Yochol Layasel Shliach Tzibur, can he become a chazan? Shol Eni Shalom Yach Pilucha, and so on, very nice, second line. Kach Nire Be'enai. It would seem to me she'en shum koach biyad aviatinok la'akev aleichem yispal. Evidently, he unfortunately never killed a young kid. Milis palel imze matityahu ela davet and so on. Vada, he says, im hayahorig nefesh b'mezid. If he was a murderer, afilu men goale anerag moni milis palel imo. Okay. Even if he was allowed, hatziburatzam tzrichim lisrachek mimenu. Okay, they have to excuse me. They have to keep away from him. And then he quotes the Rav Shrira Gaon, and then he says, "Hold on, aval." See the in the middle. Im shav b'tshuva. If he did tshuva, hareiz et zadek gomer miyad. Af al pisha dain lo asa shum din. Ela shetzorich tvila litahir miavera shetim ato. Shahavera mitam o. Kidama b'shocher tov in the medrash. And he said, and he quotes psukim and so on and so forth. The last line, shekol balei tshuva tzrichin tefillah. The experience of chet, the experience of, oh, this is a serious crime, but kol balei tshuva require tefillah. Now, the Rav has a famous Yortzeit Drosha, which he talks about the two aspects of tshuva, the tshuva's mechaper and the tshuva's metayer. But for Ashkenazim, this was not just a spiritual or a conceptual issue. For them, they literally, physically felt they were sullied by chet. They required tefillah to the extent that they felt that the tefillah that they did, Erev Yom Kippur, warranted and then mandated a bracha. So at least for our ancestors, we're talking about an entire area, not just of halacha, but of Jewish spirituality, in which the experience of unseen dimensions of what is proper and what is not, and what is attractive and what is repulsive, whether it's chet, whether it's contact with death, whether it's an aspiration for tahara to be clean and close to the Ribono Shel Olam, were not just matters to go through and to wonder what's about, but when they read Parshos Tazria and Metzora and other sections of the Torah, which is and the Chukas, of course, and they learned and they end up learning the whole Masechta Nida. I mean, was it half a dozen Dapim or Halacha L'Maisa? It wasn't just a question of the Drush V'Kabel Schar. This was in their souls. And when you look at this, and you have to say, at least, Nishalma Parm Svasim. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Wolf. We'll start the next year momentarily.